This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, I'm Evan Wasuka, and welcome to Pacific Review, where we're taking a look at the big stories from across the Pacific region over the past week. Coming up on the show, trouble in Samoa as the country's women prime minister fights for political survival in a male-dominated field. In PNG, there's growing concern over gender-based violence, with no arrests yet made over the brutal death of three women. And after more than a century away, sacred objects, including skulls, are returned back to a PNG village. We'll have more on those stories coming up. This is Pacific Review, coming to you from the lands of the Boonwurrung and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. It's Australia's version of the green card program in the United States. It's known as the Pacific Engagement Visas, and insiders say it's a mess. It was launched last year and marketed by the federal government as a way of deepening ties with the Pacific by offering permanent residency for up to 3,000 citizens from the Pacific and Timor-Leste. But more than 56,000 people applied in the first round, but successful applicants say the visa's rollout has been unsatisfactory, with a lack of communication and transparency leaving them frustrated. Lucy Cooper with more.
Seeking a fresh start for his family, Port Moresby resident Sean and his partner decided to apply for the Pacific Engagement Visa.
When we heard that news, we were really excited about it. It was like a new beginning for us.
Sean's partner was successful, just one of 3,000 applicants chosen randomly from the ballot. But soon, his excitement turned to frustration.
For my partner and myself, it's very, very, very stressful.
Sean reckons securing a job offer from an Australian employer, a requirement to apply, has been the most challenging part of the process.
Between me and my spouse, we submitted about more than 500 job offers.
He says the PEV support service, established to help applicants find a job, has been difficult to deal with.
They're slow in replying to emails. They don't have an active phone number that you can just call them on. Once we did get in touch with them, like most of the jobs were all like entry-level jobs, so like cleaners and general labourers and all that. So nothing in current fields that we were in.
Eventually, Sean found employment, but now he's waiting for his application to be approved, forcing him to delay his move to Australia.
If that time were to lapse again, I'm not sure if I'll still have a job or not. No employer is going to wait for you to 3 to 6 months.
Widely promoted by the Australian government as a way of deepening connections in the Pacific, experts say the Pacific Engagement Visa has been marred by problems.
I think it's unacceptable that individuals are experiencing a lot of frustration and mental fatigue just to get over this visa process.
That's Natasha Turia, an Australian National University scholar monitoring the PEV. She surveyed applicants on their experience with the visa. A majority said they were unsatisfied with the support service.
Time is ticking and we have not been able to get good feedback from immigration or even the PEV. It's very toxic for them to want to raise their concerns, but fear of jeopardizing their visa application just for stepping out.
There have also been significant processing delays.
One person has lost 3 job offers already, just waiting for a visa decision.
The ABC can also reveal 5 months after the ballot closed, only 100 of the 3,000 visas offered have actually been granted. Yet, the Australian government says it's satisfied.
I'm heartened by the early momentum of the scheme, and I think it will be revolutionary in improving the relationship between Australia and the Pacific.
Minister for International Development and the Pacific, Pat Conroy, said he wants the visa to be successful, and to do so, the innovative scheme will need to be improved.
I make no apology for wanting to get the scheme right, but we have to work on this scheme to make it flexible, and I'm very open to learning and working to make this scheme as successful as possible.
For Sean, it's now a waiting game to start his new life in Australia.
Kids are okay. I mean, we've explained to them the situation, but they keep, you know, asking every day, oh, when are we going? Is our visas approved? Oh, yeah, when do we start packing?
In Samoa, Prime Minister Fiame Naomi Mataafa has shown her resilience and political ingenuity by staving off two no-confidence votes in successive weeks. Samoa's government has been in political turmoil after a split emerged within the ruling FAST party in January. The opposition attempted to take advantage of this by testing Fiame's numbers in parliament, but it failed after the party rallied around her. But just 1 week later, the roles were reversed, and it was the opposition who backed Fiame in a vote brought on by the FAST party. I asked the ABC's reporter in Samoa, Adele Fruin, how Prime Minister Fiame has been able to maintain her power despite running a minority government.
Just before the actual vote of no confidence this week, the opposition told the media that they have, provided the support for Lauli and his FAST members. However, they did give their support with conditions. Now, however, during Parliament, the Speaker told both of them to go back and, come to an agreement on the amendments to their motions. They by Wednesday afternoon, they did not come to an agreement. And the Human Rights Protection Party or the opposition leader withdrew their motion and withdrew their support from Laoli's motion as well.
Yeah, it's certainly a very complex situation in terms of Samoan politics and the back and forth. Now, look, Fiame is Samoa's first woman prime minister. She's one of a few women leaders in the Pacific who's running a country. Being a woman politician is tough, but being a woman prime minister is extremely difficult. Has your gender been a factor in the attacks against her this week?
Yes, that's correct. Now, it's not just this week that she has received these attacks. At times before, during the political instability in the last 2 months, she has also had attacks on her gender. Some politicians have said previously that just because she's a woman, they won't back down their challenge against her leadership. However, this week, on the other hand, some went as far as to say that if only she was married, her husband would have counseled her properly, saying that, maybe she would, make decisions based on good counsel from having a husband, basically.
How did the Prime Minister react to these claims?
Now, Prime Minister Fiame did not take time to entertain such attacks on her gender or even on her marital status in Parliament. She went straight to, giving their side, against the motion from Lauli and his members. She was set on track on trying to, argue with, the not just Lauli's side, but also the Speaker of the House on why bring up a second motion of no confidence in less than 2 weeks, when Parliament has already passed on, the results of the first vote of no confidence. So Prime Minister Fiume was just set on, track on trying to, counter or answer to the motion against her and her cabinet.
And that was the ABC's reporter in Samoa, Adele Fruin. International Women's Day will be marked in the Pacific and around the globe this weekend as a time to celebrate women's achievements and highlight the challenges they're facing across the world. But in Papua New Guinea, the brutal death of three women and the slow response by police has been a cause for controversy. As the ABC's Belinda Cora reports from the PNG capital, Port Moresby, women's groups and the public are calling for urgent action.
There's anger and frustration on the streets of Port Moresby. It's been more than 25 days since Lina Numba Lihi was allegedly tortured and killed at a military barracks. The main suspect has fled the capital, and from his home province in East Sepik, he is negotiating his surrender with authorities.
You surrender the military police! Take him into the Sabia man farm! Put him into justice!
6 days after Lina's death, a video went viral on social media of police retrieving the body of 23-year-old Margaret Gamaro Gabriel. Police say Margaret was taken out from her home where she was allegedly raped by 20 suspects before she was tortured, mutilated and killed. No official arrests have been made, but police say more than a dozen suspects are in custody. Prime Minister James Marape has condemned the death, directing authorities to exhaust all avenues to apprehend the perpetrators.
But eventually, police will still attend to every crime committed. In the Barony killing, two arrests in May and more to come as we speak. Investigates are running. DNA samplings are being assembled. We now have lab to go really using technology to pinpoint evidence.
Despite the Prime Minister's call, the conduct of police has been questioned in the case of 20-year-old Edwina Orr. She was allegedly killed by her partner, who was apprehended, but later escaped from police custody. Though Kissam has been the voice of many affected females, she says there's been a common feature to these crimes.
A lot of the crimes that have been committed, they're committed with impunity because they know that no one's going to actually hold them accountable. And that's what our problem is. People are not animals that they can just do this and would think that there's no consequence. The problem we have is that there is no consequence for crimes that are being committed.
The deaths come as a coalition of NGOs led by Ruth Kissam's review PNG's implementation of the UN Convention on Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, CEDAW. Under CEDAW, which PNG ratified in 1995, members are obliged to oppose discrimination, violence, poverty, and the lack of legal protections. So far, PNG has failed to submit its official combined fourth and sixth cycle report to the CEDAW committee, despite an extended deadline that expired last year. Gender violence survivor and journalist Hannah Joko says women are feeling the effects of the government's failure to live up to CEDAW.
And that story was from the ABC's reporter in Port Moresby, Belinda Cora. Internet services in Fiji are considered to be among the best in the Pacific in terms of speed and cost. But that level of efficiency also means users seeking to access pornography can do so readily. And now there's growing concerns in Fiji about the rising number of visits to X-rated websites. And as Agnes Tupou reports, one of the country's senior religious leaders wants drastic action to turn back the tide.
The Catholic Church is among bodies calling on the government for a total ban of pornography in the country. Archbishop Peter Lloyd-Chong is the head of the Catholic Church and says we have a responsibility as a society to not cause harm.
Who needs it anyway? Is there a need for it? Something is no value to human beings. Then there is no sense in bringing it in anyway. So a total ban is for something that you don't need and something that just brings harm.
Now, the island nation has one of the highest rates of internet use in the Pacific, and currently there is no law prohibiting access to pornography. Letitia Shelton, CEO and founder of the City Free From Porn, says high pornography usage is the leading cause of unhealthy relationships.
Early exposure to porn leads to mental health issues, relationship breakdown, you know, sexual harassment, rape. So, yeah, I don't see where there's room for porn in any society that's good.
Ms. Shelton was part of the National Task Force set up last year by the government to protect children against pornography. Child pornography is illegal in most countries, and the average age of exposure to internet porn is 11 years old.
And heard brain surgeons talk about the impact that porn has on your brain, and therefore you begin to look at women as objects, and hence you end up doing indescribable things to them. And again, this is brought out in the rape prosecution every month. I mean, when you're seeing that 14-year-old boys are raping a baby, where do they get this from? So they're watching stuff that is putting things into their ideas and rewiring their brain. It just doesn't stay within the confines of your home because you're funding a multi-billion dollar industry that is destroying our children, our societies.
Pornography is a taboo topic in the religious and conservative communities in the Pacific, but it's become a hot topic of conversation. Archbishop Peter Lloyd-Chong says porn abuse is affecting many in the community, including those from his congregation.
Well, I'm speaking specifically about Catholics, because in the Catholic tradition, we have one of the sacraments of the church where people can come and confess their sins. And I see these people more and more now. People are confessing, like I watch porn, more men than women.
This admission took Shelton by surprise, but was happy to see that the Catholic Church was taking ownership for issues surrounding pornography.
This is the first time that I've heard the Catholic Church speak up, so that's great. I hope helping the people who sit in the pews as well, because sometimes we're good at making big statements and don't help the average person.
As for IT security consultant Jim Tora from That's IT Consultants, he says a total ban would be a step in the right direction, but it's just a band-aid solution. The effects of watching pornography can vary and depends on personal or cultural beliefs. And Tora believes more involvement from stakeholders are needed to make this ban work.
How does it improve? You know, if you're going to put this as a measure of control for a particular risk or particular issue, is it mitigating that? If you're able to block it off, you know, and some countries have done that in certain states, it's still bypassable, you know, and so people can still find ways to access those sites. Sexually explicit sites is just one component. What that roadmap should look like for the government or whichever agency is putting this in place. Once you block that off, then there needs to be some sort of other components in place to take care of what that addiction will then fit off into. It's one step in the right direction, but I think there needs to be a lot more stakeholder involvement.
In an era where internet is so easily accessed and has changed the way we interact, the possibility of a total ban on pornography can work. So let's look at North Korea, who has some of the highest level of censorship in the world, only allowing access to a domestic intranet rather than the global internet. But the question remains, where then is the online power of freedom? Tora says an end goal is needed because it is not a quick fix.
Pornography and content such as is just one component of the many issues that are out there on the internet. And I think it's important to address the issue more in terms of holistically from a national level as opposed to band-aid fixes where we need to have the data to show that this is impact correlation of that data is impacting something in society. And so I think that you need to have the subject matter experts in the room speaking with decision makers.
The Archbishop states that the rising trend and ease of access to online pornography has far deeper ramifications on one's mental state. He points out that all humans thrive on real relationships and that a person should not rely on digital interactions, citing the sacred nature of life.
Every human being, there is a holy longing. That means there's a desire for something more, the longing for God, who is the infinite. To feel that space, love can feel that, relationships can feel that, people can look elsewhere if those things, if love is not present, good relationship and parental and family, then people then try and find this elsewhere.
Though the Archbishop is adamant on the pornography ban, he says the situation needs to be approached with compassion, especially those who are addicted to such content.
You know, if you know somebody, be very compassionate with that person. He needs guidance, he needs help, he needs a support group. The last thing you want to do is go hard at them. If you find out your children are doing this, is to like avoid condemnation because that just aggravates the guilt. The best thing that parents and adults is to be very compassionate.
The Catholic Archbishop of Suva, Peter Lloyd-Chung, ending that report from Agnes Tupo. Almost 150 years ago, sacred objects, including human remains, were collected from villages in Papua New Guinea for scientific study by an eccentric Russian explorer. They've been kept in Australian museums ever since, until recently when the objects were returned. The ABC's PNG correspondent, Marion Farr, joined the trip back to the Rye Coast.
Jude Philp is preparing precious cargo for a long journey ahead.
So that involves ensuring that they're safe within the box, that nothing will go missing from their lower drawers, and that when people see them in Madang, they are appropriately prepared. You'll be able to see here some Russian wording that says Tanake from Gorandu village.
For more than a century, the remains of 16 ancestors from the Rye Coast in Papua New Guinea have been held in Australian museums. They were collected by Russian explorer Nikolai McLuho-McLay.
He went across different islands in the Pacific, but it's his 2 years on the Rye Coast of Madang that he's most famous for.
He was an early follower of Charles Darwin and a friend of Leo Tolstoy.
From the records that I read and from the images that I've seen, I'd say he was a really dedicated, highly intelligent man who was eccentric for his time.
He wanted to prove that people from different races belonged to the same species.
There was a common belief that people of colour were lesser people, and even an idea that they were different species. And he was one of those people who thought, well, if I prove it through science, those people can't debate me, because science is the way that you can be sure of things.
Now, the Chow Chak Wing Museum at the University of Sydney is handing over their care.
So we received this request in November of 2023 for the return of 16 ancestors from Astrolabe Bay from the Chow Chak Wing Museum to there. Yeah, I'm excited. It's a big, big responsibility, so excited doesn't quite capture it.
3,000 kilometres away in the PNG province of Madang, a descendant of explorer McLuho-McLay is waiting for the skulls to arrive.
I think for families of Rye Coast from Papua New Guineans, it is very important when we show that we save the history and we think about the history and we are proud of the history, and it is important.
Retracing his great-great-uncle's footsteps, Nikolai Jr. helped the villagers compose the request for their ancestors to be returned.
I think this work which started firstly because locals really want to get their ancestor and buried it motherland.
After more than a week of travelling, first via road, then by plane, the remains have arrived in PNG for the final leg of their trip, this time by boat.
Nikolai McLuho-McLay first made his journey along the Rye Coast in 1871, visiting and getting to know villagers. These human remains were given to him by six villagers in the area in 1876. Now, almost 150 years later, they're finally returning home.
When they left here, the skulls left here, we know nothing. And my ancestor didn't tell me anything about it.
Arcel Tui first learnt about his ancestor's skulls when Nikolai Jr. visited him last year.
I was talking with Junior McLeod, and he told me, I will call the names, some of them. So he said, I'll call one name, and he said, Peneki.
It's a name he recognised instantly.
It is in my clan, my tribe, and we are still preserving the names, carrying from generation to generation.
Arcel's ancestor helped the Russian explorer win the trust of locals, who eventually gifted him the skulls. More than a century later, the two families still share a strong bond.
Yeah. Yeah. All the time, our friendship will be there.
I like this job. I like this research. I like this people. Love these people, and that's why I do this.
The Chow Chak Wing Museum still holds other human remains from the Pacific. Trying to locate their descendants and send them home is a difficult task.
We will, as part of our international responsibilities, treat any request for repatriation seriously.
Any community that's receiving their ancestors home again, this is the feeling that they have. There's great sadness. There's confusion at first. And then relief and joy.
And that's Jude Phillip, Senior Curator at the Chow Chuck Wing Museum at the University of Sydney, ending that report from Marion Farr. And that's it from Pacific Review. I'm Evan Masuka. Thank you for your company. And do join me again at the same time next week for more views and news from across the Pacific region.